Is he my prince? Is he the toad? Waiting, wondering, is getting too old. I'm gonna let down my hair, slide up my skirt. Welcome to the Shame-Free Zone with Veronica Monet, your friendly former sex worker and certified sexologist. The Shame-Free Zone is a safe place for your questions and your secrets about all things sexual.
Welcome to the Shame-Free Zone. This is Veronica Monet, your host. And my guest tonight is actually a friend of mine. We haven't hung out or anything, but we've known each other for a few years, mostly because I've been one of his advertisers. He runs a magazine called The Lotus Guide out of Chico, which is in Northern California. And it's a great little magazine, actually. It's got a section for Nevada City and Grass Valley as well, and lots of alternative healing arts and workshops and health food stores and things about nutrition and sustainable agriculture. Just a really good resource. His name is Rahasya Poe, and he's actually authored a brand new book. And it's a very interesting book called To Believe or Not to Believe. And he is talking about spiritual enlightenment, which could be viewed as a bio-neurological event. So I can't wait to get started. Rahasya, welcome to the Shame-Free Zone.
Well, thank you, Veronica, for having me on.
Oh, I was looking at some of the things that you have done in your quest for this information. You've been meditating in India. You've been to the ruins of Peru. You've been to Mexico, and in Brazil you actually took, ayahuasca?
Ayahuasca.
Yes. Yes, I actually want to hear about that experience. But before we go into that, what prompted you to write this book, To Believe or Not to Believe?
Well, I suppose it's being the publisher of a magazine, I come across a lot of authors and visionaries and people out there in the world that are actually stirring things up. But I've noticed that the people that had really, really strict belief systems, really rigid belief systems, especially a belief system that wasn't really attached to what we would call everyday reality. In other words, it wasn't something you could validate. And indeed, the information in the belief system was actually a little absurd, if you know what I mean. So it got me thinking, especially when I read a quote by Voltaire, and the quote goes like this: if they can make you believe in absurdities, they can make you commit atrocities.
Right.
And I thought to myself, well, that's sort of strange, because that does seem to be the case. I mean, you go onto any battlefield or any kind of a situation where people are driven by beliefs, and they're doing some pretty atrocious things, and their beliefs are almost, without exception, pretty absurd, according to rationality and just being logical and even common sense and experience. So
yeah,
I wondered if there was a neurological aspect to that. So I started questioning neuroscientists, because I've always been interested in conscious illumination. And I can't help but think that there has to be I think the neural patterns has to be set, and you have to be in the right state of mind. It reminds me of that parable in the Bible where the household is completely out of order. The gardener's doing the cooking. The cook's doing the laundry. And what the parable says is that you need to pick out one person in the household that would be the steward of the household and get everybody doing their jobs correctly. because when the master comes to the door and knocks on the door, the household has to be in order. In other words, you need to be conscious and awake, at least to be present enough to know that something is on your doorstep. And I think people just walk around pretty much in a daze on this planet. So that search led me to the people like Andrew Newberg. He's a neuroscientist. And I was asking Andrew, I said, well, what is it about rigid belief systems that's so detrimental? What's happening here on a neurological level? And he said, if you have a really absurd belief system, something that your mind has to really struggle with to maintain and sustain itself, what happens is because it doesn't match reality, you have to start cutting off neural synapses that are connected to whole bodies of information like archaeology, anthropology, paleontology, world history, and even human experience. Because remember, for a belief to be held onto, it has to be believable. So if it's not really set in reality, you have to distort and confine and filter down everything that you know to make your mind be able to believe that belief. And he says, when you do that, what happens if you break enough neural synapses, it causes atrophy of the brain, in other words, shrinking of the brain. And he says, once that starts, it's almost impossible to stop it because you've set it on a path of discovery, and your brain actually believes that it has found some truth, because now all of a sudden the mind, its whole reality matches what the belief is, unknowingly, because they've filtered out all of this information.
You've just given a whole another level to, I've always had a favorite saying, which is mine. I always say beliefs are dangerous, and I usually endeavor to have as few of them as I possibly can, because I like to leave my brain more malleable than that. But when I think about, you know, beliefs are dangerous, I'm thinking about the wars and the people that have been, you know, killed, the genocides. I think about a misappropriation of the Earth's resources. I never even thought that it would actually deteriorate the brain. That's amazing.
Yeah, and actually, Andrew Newberg says, I said, do you have a word for this? He says, yeah, we call it brain damage. I said, don't you have something a little more scientific? He says, no, that's exactly what it is. It actually causes brain damage.
Wow.
And I think we've seen this in so many people. I mean, for centuries, we've called these people like narrow-minded, short-sighted, tunnel vision.
Little did we know, huh? That was actually happening,
it was really
happening to them.
A neurological aspect.
Right, exactly, physiologically. So when you were talking to Dr. Newberg, did he give you any insights on what motivates the human organism to move in this direction towards atrophy? What is it about beliefs that becomes so, intoxicating?
What starts something like that in motion is our desire to belong to groups, naturally. And here's where it gets really tricky, because here we are talking about this, but the reality is even back as far as the Roman Empire, nation-states have known this for a long time. Nation-states have known that to get people out on the battlefield requires a certain mindset, and they found the perfect mindset, and that is religious fanatics, because for a religious person to be out there, they've, by definition, already limited their worldview down to they think that only they have the true God, and only they can talk to him or listen to him. And so they've already set in motion this whole mental attitude to go out on the battlefield and basically die for their country. And when nation states realized this, they made a deal with religions. They said, okay, look, you guys don't have to pay any taxes. We'll watch over you and protect you, but you have to give divine sanction for the state's actions. And that's why to this day our soldiers go into battle. They get down on their knees and pray to their God, and the other side gets down on their knees and prays to their God. And it gets into, well, CNN and insanity is what we're faced with today.
Well, okay, yes, I get how it has having people, a bank of people, to a pool of people that you can draw from, who are basically little obedient robots. You can kind of get them all wound up to do your bidding. I see how that benefits powerful people who want to accomplish certain ends. But I'm wondering,
sure, yeah.
I'm wondering about the individual themselves. I find it very frightening when I look at the voting polls, and I think about, for instance, Perry right now, how anybody could be voting for that man, or even in the primaries, is kind of shocking to me. It seems to me that oftentimes there's a propensity for picking leaders, or at least potential leaders, who are actually coming from kind of an abusive model, especially when you see that a lot of the people who are voting for those people are literally voting against their own self-interest, voting against their own medical coverage, their own income, their own ability to feed themselves and their kids. And I think, what is it about the beliefs? Because it's obviously the beliefs that, if they can get kind of stirred up around God and country, it seems logic really doesn't even come into the equation. And, of course, I'm coming from a liberal overlay
here. If logic came into the equation, they wouldn't be out on the battlefield.
Yes, right. I get where I totally understand what the benefit is to the system, and I'm a huge fan of Alice Miller's book. Was it the Thou Shalt Not Be Aware? Are you familiar with that?
No.
She talks about the poisonous pedagogy and how very early these little buttons are planted, first by our parents, then by the schools, and then by the corporations that we go to work for, and the governments, of course, that we serve. But I think the part that's missing for me is each individual person. What is the appeal to having a blind belief system? I have sometimes wondered if it is like an addictive response, that it's lazy. You just kind of get this emotional hit from thinking that way.
And well, there is a chemical counterpart to any belief system, actually any emotion. Candace Pert wrote in her book, Molecules of Emotion, that anytime you have any emotion, there are a soup of peptides and hormones that are produced with that emotion. Like if you're feeling melancholy, you produce benzodiazepine. And you actually get addicted to that chemical. In other words, if you get addicted to feeling like poor, poor, pitiful me, for instance, we've all met the person that is just thinking that the world is out to get them and it always happens to them, but they're addicted to feeling that way. So consequently, what we do if we're addicted to that chemical is we go out into the world unconsciously and manifest situations that will produce that particular environment to produce that particular situation to cause us to feel that way. And, of course, the people say something like, I knew this was going to happen to me. Well, of course, it always happens to them because they set themselves up. And we do that with every emotion. But I think back to the question of the individual, I think a good example of this is, well, first of all, our complete educational system has been methodically dumbed down. I mean, dumbed down to the point to where we're dysfunctional as a society right now. Our educational system is all but collapsing, and it's produced so many of the people in power today, and our whole civilization is producing people, like when you go to school, they're cramming knowledge into you. But this knowledge really isn't wisdom. It's the knowledge to go out and do something in the world to make more money, to be a better consumer or a manipulator. And it ends up turning you into a mindless robot. I guess the point in question is the guy that dropped the bomb on Hiroshima. You know, this guy was a complete moron, because anyone, I mean, anyone with even a mild sense of presence, if somebody would say to me, hey, can you fly this plane and drop this bomb and kill 100,000 innocent people? I would say no. I mean, I think most intelligent people would do that. But this guy not only dropped the bomb, but he returned home from his mission, and he slept that night really, really good. And they asked him the next day, how did you sleep? He goes, I slept fine because I did my job, and that's all I need to know. So he was like a robot.
Don't you think, Rahasia, don't you think that saying that somebody is a moron or stupid or unintelligent is probably a little too simplistic, that there are some very intelligent, capable people who succumb to this kind of groupthink, and also to obviously submitting to authority. I certainly know some very intelligent people who seem to get really caught up in mob mentality, in you know, just even like the excitement around team sports. It to me, there really is nothing going on there, but the emotional loop that people get around that is very self-perpetuating. And I can't help but wonder if, when you're talking about the brain chemistry, if there isn't also some kind of a payback, that maybe like an immediate high or a sensation of being safe or secure or part of the tribe. I'm just wondering what other things might be operating that perpetuate this, because for myself, I'm an independent thinker, haven't really been referenced to a peer group most of my life. For me, it's a phenomenon I look at with a lot of curiosity. And I'm just wondering, you've interviewed some amazing people here. You had Neil Donald Walsh and you know, Fred Allen Wolf, Gary Zukav. Somewhere in there, did anybody talk about what it is that draws people to this way? Certainly we know who would want to take advantage of it, but what attracts otherwise sane people to this sort of what I would consider very simple thinking?
Well, I think to be an original thinker, and when it comes to intelligence, we would really have to get into defining what is intelligence, but to be an original thinker in today's world is a rare find, a really rare find. I remember talking to Gary Zukav about this, and he said one of the things that has caused this is our early evolutionary times when we were so patriarchal and we were the masculine energy was running high and we were in defense mode. And almost all of our organizations is based upon that, even up until today. But I think what's happening, the more feminine energy starts playing a role in our world and our society, we're starting to see a softening of that, and it's actually sort of putting a light on the insanity, you might say. What once seemed normal and acceptable is starting to seem not so normal and not so acceptable now, and almost a distaste or an uneasiness to do some of the things we used to do. So I think belonging to the clan, belonging to the group, that's an alluring thing. No one wants to feel like they're alone. And I think we all have this aloneness that we have to eventually handle. And it's in that aloneness that we come face to face with the mystery. And at that point, you better have the spiritual fortitude to look at it and realize that you don't know. I mean, it's so tempting to start making up beliefs and pretend like you know something. But when you look at that mystery and embrace it, something happens. But keep in mind, you can't do this if you're still embedded with beliefs. You have to dismantle your beliefs. I mean, really methodically dismantle them. And when you look at the mystery of life, this is what opened up for me writing the book, actually. It opened it up even more the more I thought about this. But when the mystery of life is embraced by your spirit and your being, it's not like this scary thing. It's this awesome feeling that realize you've been missing by going around pretending like you knew the answers to stuff. Because deep down inside, we know that we don't know. And this is the fear. And this is why believers get so aggressive, so defensive, if anybody starts undermining their belief. Because at the core of their being, they're realizing that they actually don't know. So they get overly defensive.
I think it's very frightening for people not to know, but a couple of people that you interviewed, at least like Neil Donald Walsh and Byron Katie, I would think do have some belief systems that they promulgate, and they've also got followers who believe in some of the things that they put out there. Do you differentiate that kind of belief with some of the other beliefs that you're talking about in this book?
Oh, yeah. When I interviewed Byron Katie, I actually didn't agree with her, but the whole point of the book isn't to go out and find people that are thinking the same way I'm thinking. I wanted to talk with people that put me in check and turn me around.
Okay.
And during the process of that interview, you'll notice if you read that interview, things turned around for both of us, actually. And Neil Donald Walsh, I mean, anyone that says he talks to God, I had to talk to him. My wife and I, we went up to Ashland. And
right.
I wanted to talk to this guy. But what he had to say really put a lot of things in a nice perspective, so I wanted to include it. But
well,
can you give
the listeners at least some hint of what that nice perspective was?
Well, he was talking about some of his own personal experiences. And again, even for him, it got down to the point of dismantling some of his old Christian beliefs so he could see God in a new way. And he said that he wouldn't have been able to do that if he hadn't done the previous work of dismantling those beliefs, because they were filtering out too much. Not only filtering out, but things ever so discreetly into different areas.
Sometimes I wonder if we get attached to our belief systems because of the fact that perhaps reality can be at least partially shaped by what we believe. And if we allow our belief systems to be too open-ended, maybe we're afraid we're going to create too much anarchy, too much that's unreliable, that we can't count on. So if we have certain beliefs, perhaps they become evidenced in our environment, and then that creates a certain sense of safety for us. What do you think about that?
Well, when we're talking about beliefs, we have to realize, too, that we use that word for a lot of different things. So if we're talking about a belief that could be interchangeably used with the word intention, that's not the kind of beliefs that we're talking about.
In your book.
I run across this quite a bit with my spiritual New Age friends. They say, well, you're manifesting your world, you're creating your reality, and you have to believe this. But that's not the belief I'm talking about. The beliefs that we're talking about are these dogma, really rigid, doctrinal kinds of patriarch belief systems that have divided our world and put it against itself to the point. I mean, if this was even 200 years ago, it wouldn't be so bad. I mean, the battlefields were bloody, and, you know, we've been doing this for centuries. But even 200 years ago, if you wanted to kill a million of the others, you had to get pretty close to a million people to believe that you need to go out and do this. You had to get all kinds of armament and ways to get the army there and food and supplies. I mean, it was a massive undertaking. But in today's world, with advanced technology, all you need is one believer with a suitcase bomb sitting in New York, and he can do the same thing. So this is a game changer now. We're reaching a period to where we can no longer sit back and just let these things play out, because if we continue to let this happen, somebody asked Einstein, what are we going to fight, you know, to use to fight in World War III? And he said, well, I don't know, but World War IV is going to be fought with sticks and stones.
Yes.
We can't afford to go to war anymore. Yeah, and it's very true. It wouldn't take much to really crumble and collapse our society. It's almost collapsing by itself right now because of our belief systems. We have built this unsustainable, even our financial institutions are built on this weird principle of consumerism. And consumerism is, it can only possibly work if we lived on an infinite planet, but we don't. We live on a finite planet with finite resources, but we built a financial institution that can only survive as long as the Dow Jones and all these numbers keep rising and climbing. And if they drop just 200 points, everyone freaks out. But it can't just keep climbing forever. We don't live on that kind of a planet. So we have to really, really think about how we've done things and how we've shaped our world according to ideas and beliefs that,
well,
you know, maybe...
Don't you think, Rahasia, that some of the beliefs that are driving our culture right now aren't even... they're not even married to things that are tangible. I mean, when you bring up something like the stock market, you know, a lot of that is just a figment of people's imagination. It's what a bunch of people get together and agree to become hysterical about. And depending on, you know, their level of hysteria, then that creates the economy. I personally, you know, at its most basic level, I think an economy should be basically, you know, here's a house and here's some food. Here's a way to keep yourself warm. Here's a way to
right,
you know, create transportation for yourself. We've really gotten far away from those basics that define life on this planet. And, you know, I can remember during the boom when the economy was up, meeting somebody who, you know, was a financial, wizard, I suppose. It was a young man working in the stock market, and they said, what do you do for a living? I said, well, I move people's money. I mean, how is it you can even get paid to do something like that? It doesn't produce any kind of a tangible worth for anyone. But it's almost as if our brains have gotten so abstract that we're not living in our own bodies anymore. We're not connecting to that. And when I think about how many people are on medications nowadays, you know, there's a vast majority of American citizens who are taking one form of medication or another, oftentimes antidepressants, something that actually affects their brain chemistry. And how we could ever expect those people to feel connected to the earth or connected to each other, it just seems almost like this impossible thing to overcome. Did you at any point in your book talk about the use of psychotropic medications and how that has really become commonplace at this point. People are either doing attention deficit disorder drugs when they're, you know, children and adolescents, or antidepressants by the time they reach adulthood. Do you talk about that in your book?
This particular subject came up with Bruce Lipton. He's a pioneering microbiologist. And he said the problem, what started here, is this mechanical view of the universe. We think that it's a nature versus nurture kind of a thing. And he says what we do in medicine, in biological research and nutrition and dealing with illness, is we think that if we see a disease, we can go in there and add a molecule and fix the disease. But that's not the case. That the body works in such a holistic kind of a way that you can't just artificially put a molecule in there and cover up the symptoms and go on from there. But this gets into a whole, I mean, our whole atmosphere, our water supply, our genetically modified foods. There's so much chemistry. Monsanto is just making a destructive force in this planet that it's really hard to even wrap my head around sometimes. I mean, people know
like
that
just
Roundup,
trying to destroy life.
Yeah, Roundup, their number one ingredient to kill weeds. Everyone knows that it causes cancer, but I still see mostly old people out there with their little spray can spraying the weeds with Roundup, you know, breathing all that stuff. And you get into all the plastics, which are just made out of fossil fuels. And look around your room right now. I mean, almost everything in that room has come from petrol in one form or another, either making it, transporting it, but most of the stuff in our car is just made from oil, and we don't realize what an effect that is having on us.
Well, you know, you're right about that. I rarely think about that. I think about fuel. I may think about, you know, buy locally in order to avoid, you know, shipping things by truck, but I don't think about the plastics being made out of petroleum products.
Yeah,
so it's
we live
incredibly
in a
pervasive
world,
yeah. What?
But get it. Go ahead.
No, I was just going to say, you know, what do you think the solution is? Does your book offer hope? It's a pretty dismal picture. I think a lot of us are on board for that. Do you offer hope or
well,
a way out?
It is nice to look at the positive part of this, and you really have to work with this a little bit to see the positive part, because actually, the truth being told, I think it pretty much has to collapse. The whole world economy, our whole world civilization, it almost has to collapse, because trying to rebuild within the system, I mean, look at the government. Go into the government and try to change one little thing. You can't do it. And everything that would take to make our government work better, our Congress is so dysfunctional, they can't even write the bills that would correct themselves. So I think, in a sense, it does have to collapse. And I think that there's going to be some hard times for a lot of people. But in the end, we will rise from the ashes. I really, truly do think that that's true. But it's going to be tough. It's going to be real tough. But I think, hopefully, we will have learned our lesson and start building a more sustainable society. And there's something else happening, too, on a subtle, energetic level. As we tilt back towards the center of the galaxy, we're getting lots of new energies coming into humanity. And now we're getting into one of my beliefs, but I've really thought about this, and it seems like it matches a lot of information, even from NASA and astronomical events and energies and everything. But it seems to me that there is a window of opportunity opening up for mankind that will allow us to take this evolutionary step of consciousness, because consciousness has been slowly but surely evolving, but now we are becoming participants in that evolution. So now it's a conscious evolution instead of just an evolution of consciousness. And I think as we get more and more into this and get more people to wake up, literally, spiritually, consciously, I think we're going to see something happen almost magical on this planet. And all the prophecies speak about this, the Hopis, the Mayans, they all speak about this time. Even the Christians have a way of looking at it, but I think it's limited to their worldview at the time, but they call it Christ consciousness. But
right.
Eventually, I think we're all headed for another total way of seeing and being in this world that, to this point, we're so divided and so cellular with our outlook that it's hard for us to wrap our minds around this. But again, this is the important thing about breaking down your beliefs, because almost all beliefs are ego-based. And that ego is what keeps us divided and fights for survival, because it'll do anything that it has to do to survive in your mind. But when you start breaking that down and letting the mystery in, I guess you just have to take my word for it, but something really starts to move inside. And when that starts to move, you realize that you can't go back anymore. And all of these worldviews and religions and histories and philosophies and all of the ideologies, they all start looking really bizarre and absurd when you start looking with this more expanded vision.
Well, let's go into some of your personal experiences, Rahasia. I'd love to hear what it was that prompted you to do ayahuasca, for instance, in Brazil. Could you tell us a little bit about that experience?
Sure.
But first, just start off with why you went to Brazil to do ayahuasca.
Well, actually, I was coming back from India. I'd spent a few months in India learning a certain kind of meditation. It's like an active meditation. It's a sort of a mixture of Eastern and Western kinds of therapies. And so coming back from India, I was fresh out of that, and someone told me that, hey, next time you have some free time, come on down to Brazil and try some ayahuasca, because they knew I was into the psychotropic drugs. I'd taken some DMT and LSD and just sort of experimenting that way, and realized that there are some inner doors of perception that do get opened. But when I went to Brazil, and for about 3 months, every Friday, I would take a pretty heavy dose of ayahuasca. And the first two or three times, it was all about purging. I mean, you regurgitate, but it's a purging of your negative emotions. And when you purge enough, and you get your system clean enough, that's when the spirits come in through the plant. And I know Fred Allen Wolf and I, we talked about this once for about 3 hours, because that's what brought him out of his traditional quantum physics into this metaphysical realm, is he took ayahuasca. But when I took ayahuasca over and over and over and over, it started opening up these inner doors, and I actually had beings coming to me and telling me things and opening my eyes to the fact that it seems like the biggest message was simply this: we live in a biological being. We live and we breathe and we have our being inside of a living being. And from the beginning of time, it seems like there has been this, like a conscious desire of, call it God, call it universal mind, you can put any kind of label on it, but there's something underneath the matrix, the fabric of matter that keeps bubbling up and self-organizing itself into higher and more complex patterns. Like in the beginning, that it would organize itself into atoms, and then from atoms that come together as molecules, and molecules to cells, and cells to organisms. Well, now here we are as planetary cells, these organisms, and if all these billions of years of doing this are still in play, and I suggest that we're not the total culmination of what nature has in mind for evolution of consciousness, the next step from here would be for us as planetary cells to connect with each other and form a planetary global mind. And I think I see this happening even with on an outer level. It started years ago with the post office, the Pony Express, and mail systems, and now it's the internet. We're already connecting mind to mind, but that's just a outer reflection of what's happening spiritually and consciously as we're getting ready to take this next step of consciousness. And people like Pierre de Chardin, he wrote about this. He was a Jesuit priest. He wrote about this years ago, and he called it a convergence of mankind, a merging together of minds. And he said we would create, like, he called it a new sphere, like a biosphere of consciousness. And as we all start becoming part of that, we give ourselves over to that, to the greater good. But to do that, we have to do the inner work of dismantling all these beliefs that keep the ego so alive. Because in that final moment of surrender, what you're surrendering is everything that you think you are. And if you can't do that, you're going to keep yourself divided from that new conscious global mind. And there's going to be a lot of people probably left behind in fear and combativeness and competition and doing all the old stuff until they finally, I don't know what's going to happen to them, but it's not going to be good for them, because the whole world is going to be moving into this other direction, and we have no precedent in history to explain this other than to look at the other epochs when this consciousness has done this before, when cells formed together to make an organism. There was a time period when those cells were just cells, individuated cells. They started connecting to make an organism. This was another evolutionary step where consciousness, God, mind, universe, it was putting itself into the fields of matter and time in a higher, more complex form. And I think we're getting ready to take that next step. We're right.
So would you say, when you talk about this, are you talking about people that literally becoming one organism, or are you envisioning something more like a beehive or an ant colony? What exactly are you envisioning?
It's more like a hive type consciousness.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like, and who knows what this is going to look like, Veronica? I think we're talking about a world that is so far beyond our individuated minds to even fathom. But I'm sure that something is going to happen, almost mystical, and I think it has something to do with what we're talking about right now. And this is we're seeing more and more compassion on the planet right now. It's in pockets. And we're forcing all of the competitiveness, the patriarchal aggression and everything, it's being really pushed and forced down to tiny pockets on the planet right now. And we're putting a microscope on it. I mean, the whole world is looking at this insanity right now. So I think it's just the idea that we have to pay attention. You know, that one of the sayings that come out of the Middle East that I think is sort of good is believe in Allah, but tie up your camel first. There's this balance that we have to do. We have to have an inner certitude that we're going in the right direction, but always being able to play with that and being open to other ideas. But at the same time, we really need to be careful right now, because we have a lot of people on this planet really wants to bring this whole system to a nightmarish ending, because in that nightmarish ending is what they've been waiting for and prophesizing for years, the Christians, you know, Armageddon. And what most Christians don't realize is that the word Armageddon, Apocalypse. I don't know where they got the four horsemen of the apocalypse and all the fear and the death and everything, but the original Hebrew word for apocalypse actually means a lifting of the veil. And when you talk to rabbis, like people that have really scholarly looked into the old Hebrew and actually know the Bible, which very few Christians do, sadly enough, but when you talk to them, you get a whole other idea of what went on at that time. And we probably won't have time to go into part three of the book, but this is where this took me as I started going into the historical background of not only the Bible, but the Quran, the Mahabharata, the Ramayana, all these Vedic literatures that have gone back centuries. When you go back to the absolute beginning of this, you get down to the Sumerian and pre-Babylonian histories, and all of the Sumerian clay tablets that they've dug up this past century that most people don't know about still. It's amazing. But when you go into those clay tablets and start reading things like the Epic of Creation or the Epic of Gilgamesh, you realize that the early stories of the Bible are pretty much watered down, edited down, plagiarized versions of older, much, much older, maybe even millennia, stories that goes back into our far distant past and has to do with a group of beings called the Anunnakis. And the Anunnakis, the way the Sumerian tablets lays this out, were from another planet. They came here looking for gold, and this is a very complex story, so I'm really
And this is part three of the book.
Digest.
So, you mentioned the Epic of Gilgamesh, and I'm familiar with that. What do you have a particular interpretation of the Epic of Gilgamesh that you'd like to share with our listeners tonight?
Sure, it's basically the story of Noah and the flood, the deluge. And when you read the Epic of Gilgamesh, you realize that this is the Noah story that supposedly only happened, you know, a few thousand years ago. But this flood probably happened anywhere from 10 to 12, maybe even 15,000 years ago. And the story dates back to that time. It was a whole different society, too.
Are you familiar with the part of the story where the madman is running around in the forest copulating with the beast of the field, and his king sends him to see a courtesan to civilize him?
Yeah, I do remember a part of that.
Yeah.
Yeah, one of the things that happens in the Sumerian text is this story. It's like very complex, but basically the Anunnakis came here and genetically altered us and brought us up to another level of consciousness. They brought us from Homo erectus to Homo sapiens. And this is why there's a missing link in evolution.
Now, Rahate, I'm going to put you on the spot here. It sounds to me like you have a belief.
Well, it is a belief, but it's based upon thousands and thousands and thousands of clay tablets, archaeological finds, and paleontology. I mean, there is so much science that backs this up. And even the theory of evolution backs this up, because it does seem like that we evolved to a period of time and then all of a sudden took a giant leap and became modern man. And this is where the intelligent design people come in and say, aha, this explains God. All of a sudden, we're here. But what the evolutionists don't understand and what the intelligent design people don't understand is this could have been an alien intervention into our bloodline. And when you start delving into this, I mean, even the word bloodline gets into a whole bloodline that dates back to these early people and the original patriarchs and kings and queens that were the original people that were part of these early researches by the Anunnakis. But yeah, I guess you could call it a belief system, but
sounds like one to me, but it's interesting. And we are running out of time, Rahasia, but I really want to thank you so much for joining me in the Shame-Free Zone. And once again, I want to tell people, To Believe or Not to Believe is the name of Rahasia Poe's book. You can find it. What is the easiest way to link to your website here? Do you have an easy one? I'm looking at a very complicated link online right now.
Yeah, the easiest way is just to go to my website, which is rahasiapoe.com.
Let's spell that for people. That's go ahead and spell that.
It's rahasiapoe.com. rahasiapoe.com.
Great. Great. And there you can get a copy of the book, To Believe or Not to Believe.
Yep.
Got some fabulous names in here of people that you've interviewed. Shakti Gowon as well. And Neil Donald Walsh and Byron Katie, Gary Zukav, Bruce Lipton, Joe Dispenza, Andrew Newberg. Got a pretty good lineup of forward thinkers.
When you tackle something like beliefs, you want as many people behind you as possible.
Okay. Rahasia, thank you so much. To my listeners out there, I want to let you know what I'm up to in the next few weeks, actually. Tomorrow night, I'm going to be teaching a teleseminar with Francesca Gentile. It's called Embodying the Divine Feminine, or How to Befriend Your Inner Whore. And it's a four-part series. It's via the telephone. You can listen to us live tomorrow night from 6 to 7 p.m. Pacific time, or you can just sign up for the four-part series, and it's available basically as a podcast. Either way, you can contact me directly if you're interested, veronica@theshamefreezone.com. or 888-903-0050. And I'd be happy to get you enrolled into the teleseminar, which is actually 50% off right now. It was about $99.95. Now it's $49.95. And you also get about $100 worth of free gifts. Also on the calendar here, Saturday, September 24th, Saturday, at the First Unitarian Universalist Church in San Francisco. I'm going to be teaching Actually, it's not really a workshop. It's more of a presentation. We'll probably have a little bit of workshop flavor to it, but it's 1:30 to 3 p.m. that afternoon, and it's entitled A Doorway to the Divine. It's all part of the first conference on Earth-based, nature-centered, polytheistic, and indigenous faiths, which is hosted by the Pagan Alliance. So if you want to know more about that, again, you can contact me at veronica@theshamefreezone.com or just call me toll-free at 888-903-0050. Thanks so much for joining me in the Shame Free Zone, and I'll see you next Monday.
Hey.
Thank you for tuning in tonight. If you liked what you heard and you want more solutions for your love life, please call me toll-free at 888-903-0050. Once again, that number is 888-903-0050. I am the only person who answers that line, and I am usually available Monday through Friday from 10 a.m. to 10 p.m. Pacific Time. You can also visit sexwithoutshame.com to discover more of what I can do for you. And remember, your secret is safe with me. Sering kesepian, kenapa tak mentus kabar berita?